Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another edition of the Experience Hockey Talk, Serious Hockey Talk for Serious Hockey fans. This is Mike. Ethan is not with me at this moment, and that is because, ladies and gentlemen, we couldn't get him last week because of work. We'll explain it in a moment. We talked about it last week, but we'll explain it more in a moment. It's our good friend, author of Chasing the Dream, Life in the AHL, Red Rising, and Transition Game, and he is the Capitals contributor for the Hockey Writers, our good friend, Ted Starkey. Ted, welcome back to the podcast. It's been a few years.
It has. It's good. Always good to be back, though.
So, as I was alluding to, you weren't on last week as we originally had pitched, and that was because Mike Bossy had passed away.
Right.
And then of recording today, we're recording this on Friday, April 22nd, Guy Lafleur passed away this morning. So real quick, why don't you talk about the passing of Mike Bossy and then also the passing of Guy Lafleur and what they both mean to the game of hockey?
I mean, it's a shame this year, you know, particularly for the Islanders, to lose Clark Gillies and Mike Bossy in the same year. We were talking about how the four-time cup winners are really revered. I mean, you know, obviously they still have a record of 19 straight playoff series. They're the last four cup dynasty in the NHL. One of the greatest teams ever assembled. You know, if you look at Bossy's career, when he was healthy, he was one of the most dominant players. And, you know, his one negative part of his game is he didn't stay healthy. I mean, he retired at age 30, which is amazing. But, you know, his body just broke down. But, you know, he was one of the purest goal scorers. And, you know, Guy Lafleur was a little bit before Bossy in terms of his dominance. He obviously was part of the Canadiens dynasty, one of the greatest players. He's more famous, I think, for his hair as well, because he always had the no helmet and the hair flowing when he skated. He played with the Canadiens until the mid-80s and retired and then came back for the Rangers and Nordiques. But he still was another one who was an integral part of one of the dynasties of the NHL of that era. And, you know, it's really sad because, you know, both of them passed within a few weeks of each other. And, you know, they both were big icons of 70s and 80s hockey. And, you know, they kind of were emblematic of what it was. It was free skating. It was a lot of offense and, you know, really skilled players. And, you know, at the time, you know, the NHL had a lot of some skilled players and some not so skilled players, but, you know, Bossy and Lafleur were two of the best skilled players around.
Yeah. And one of the comments I saw was apparently when Lafleur first came into the NHL, he wore a helmet, and they said the moment he got rid of the helmet and he let his hair flow, he became a superstar.
Yep. So, I mean, and that's the other thing, and you figure, you know, in those days you didn't have to wear a helmet, and, you know, obviously a couple of players didn't, you know, even Langway, when he was with the Canadians, he wore a helmet. When he came to Washington, he took it off, and it's, you know, you don't see that anymore, but, you know, Lafleur was one of those recognizable guys with the, you know, the long hair, and, you know, we would always be just iconic player for the Canadians.
Now, we're both history guys. We love history of Caps, history of the NHL, you know, history of hockey in general. So let me throw this out there, since we're talking about guys not wearing helmets. Who was the last player to not wear a helmet in the NHL?
I believe it was McTavish, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah,
it was like late 90s too. Yes. I think it was right before Gretzky retired.
Right. Although there's a technicality. Remember, they rescinded the rule for a while and Brett Hull went helmetless in an All-Star game. So technically, he's the last guy to participate in an NHL event without a helmet.
That doesn't count. Nobody counts the All-Star game.
Yes, but the thing is, you know, the they took it away because they thought some players might have it. But, you know, obviously insurance-wise, and you'd never do that now because obviously you don't want to end up with a concussion or hit with a puck or something like that or lose your, you know, lose your vision because of an errant stick.
Yeah, I mean, well, nowadays when players come in the league, you have no choice but to wear a visor on your helmet.
Right.
And of course, like,
and also, I was going to say the game is different too, because when you're back days, if you didn't have a helmet, you kind of aware that the people around you didn't have helmets either. So you didn't, you know, you kind of were more conscious to keep your stick down. You know, it's like with goaltenders with no masks, you know, you wouldn't see the headhunters you'd see today. But obviously now kids come through, you have a full cage until you go pro or you go to junior. So you're not used to, you know, if your stick gets high, you're going to whack somebody in the helmet, but you're not going to, you know, hit him in the head.
Yeah. And of course, but like when you also look at guys like a Leo Komarov or a Carl Hagelin, they don't even wear the visor properly, which, let's be honest, that's why Carl Hagelin got the eye injury that he got, you know.
Right.
Not trying to shame Carl, remember, Hagelin, and, you know, but I'm just saying, you know, wear your visor properly, you're not going to have that problem.
Well, the funniest was the old, you know, the Gretzky and the Dale Hunter helmets, you know, the old broomball helmets. They had the warning inside, not used for ice hockey. You know,
and how ironic they both retired the same year.
Yep, exactly. But yeah, no. So it's, you know, it's always been like that. But yeah, unfortunately, with the visors now, it's like you got to wear them properly because, you know, players don't really control their sticks like they used to. I mean, like I said, if you had a guy that you knew had no helmet or no visor, you're a little bit more careful. Now, you know, players aren't quite as careful because they're not used to it. You know, everywhere, every level they've been on has been this level of protections available, so I don't have to worry about it.
And I remember playing, you know, from like 92 to 2005, I believe it was, or late 2004, you know, you had no choice but to wear a cage for USA Hockey. That was like the rule for USA Hockey. Like once you turned 18, you were allowed to move away from it. But like, you know, you had to wear a cage.
And even if you're, you know, if you're playing in college, you got to wear a cage or a visor. You got to wear a full visor. You can't, you know, juniors will allow you to wear just the shield, but you know, if you're playing the NCAA, they do not allow you to wear any kind of half visor. You got to wear the full cage or the full plastic mask.
Well, to be fair, I wasn't good enough to make it to college. Juniors, but
the players today do. You know, they're used to it.
Yeah.
You know, and as I said, you're like you're saying, like with the visors, but you know, as I said, they're used to full cages until they turn pro.
Are you surprised that more guys, especially the fact that they're used to the cage, don't bring the cage with them to the NHL?
I think a lot of it, I mean, it used to be with the helmets, it used to be pride. I think a lot of players didn't want to seem like they needed protection. I think now a lot of it is the vision. They have issues. Some people have issues looking at their skates, you know, and they feel like the cage is a hindrance to what they can see. You know, I think insurance wise, obviously, I think teams would rather have it, but I think the players are kind of pushing back because they think they can't play as well because they can't see the puck down low. You know, it's always been a kind of a slow drag with this kind of thing because, you know, you have guys who want to be rough and tough and pretend nothing can happen to them. You know, obviously, as I said, this game had a generations of players without helmets, players without goalie masks. And, you know, it's kind of been a slow evolution to what they wear now. But, you know, eventually you may see it because it may be a requirement or if someone has a really serious injury, you know, sometimes, unfortunately, that's the big harbinger of these issues is when, you know, when Goldsworthy passed away, you started to see more players wearing helmets. You had guys like Berard with eye injuries. You started to see more guys with visors, you know, if anything, you know, fortunately the NHL hasn't had any serious incidents in recent years, but if something that comes into effect, you may see a push for more facial protection.
Well, it's interesting that you brought up Brian Berard because I remember that game when he took the stick to the eye.
Right.
That caused him to miss, like, I think, what was it, like 2 years that he missed, essentially?
Yeah.
And, but the NHL, like, yeah, you saw guys be proactive and, you know, start wearing visors, but the NHL really dragged their feet on making it mandatory. I don't think they made it mandatory until at least a good 10 to 15 years after the incident happened.
Yeah, and usually the league is kind of like, it's when it's already kind of decided. I mean, the same thing with helmets. Helmets really weren't required until a lot of the players already had them. There's, you know, a very small minority, and they eventually grandfathered them out. You know, obviously Langway was one of the guys who didn't have one. That was more because of, you know, he started in the league before it was required, and they didn't require him to have it. So, you know, it's a lot of it is pressure from the players. I mean, honestly, if something happens to a player, maybe you'll see them, you know, kind of reconsider. But for now, I mean, I think, you know, they're used to the cages and the visors, the full visors. But I think once they come, when you aren't required to have it, I think a lot of players just don't see the need for it. I mean, obviously, if you have guys with a broken jaw or something like that, then you have it. But, you know, I think that's going to be a couple decades off, I would think.
Yeah. Shifting away from equipment, because that was something we didn't plan on talking about, but it just kind of popped up because of Guy Lafleur, and that was kind of like a reflection on him.
Right.
But one thing that you've been doing, and you actually started doing this during the height of the pandemic, was you actually started uploading retro videos of the Washington Capitals games. The one that you posted today, again, we're recording on Friday, April 22nd, was the game of this day in 1988, which was game three between the Capitals and the Devils in a 1988 Patrick Division final game.
Right.
What inspired you to start uploading the games, and what type of reaction have you been getting from it besides me retweeting you every single day when you post these videos?
Well, it actually started back when I was in high school. I did a lot of video editing, and I would tape. We didn't get home team sports until 1987. We didn't get VCR until 1987, which is why there's a pretty significant drop off in games before then. But while I was in high school, I had a bunch of tapes. They basically ended up in the attic for a couple decades. And during the pandemic, I mean, I realized that what a lot of fans don't know is a lot of the home team sports library, which carried the games, you know, during the 80s and 90s, a lot of those games aren't anywhere anymore. They don't exist on tape because tape was very valuable, or someone, you know, used the tape or something else. So basically I figured, you know, it was good to kind of digitize some of these games. You know, other teams like Nesson with the Bruins, MSG with the Rangers and Islanders and Devils, a lot of those games are still in existence because they had them, you know, they preserved them. Whereas home team sports, after Comcast bought them in the mid 90s, I don't think there was a real priority on archiving them. So I figured, you know, I bought an inexpensive digitizer, basically hooked it up to VCR and let them run that. And then, you know, eventually uploaded a bunch. Mostly home team sports or DC20 broadcasts. There are other games too, non-Caps games that I recorded, but it's just basically whatever survived my attic, you know, whatever I didn't tape over, whatever, you know, just lasted. And, you know, I've got a great reaction from, you know, former players, former announcers who've seen it, obviously. They haven't seen a lot of these tapes in years, so it's kind of interesting. And, you know, it's a different thing to see a hockey game called then. You didn't have score bugs. You didn't have constant on-screen stats like you did now. I mean, I talked to the old home team sports play-by-play announcer Mike Forens, and we were talking about the difference of the game now. And he was saying, you know, now there's so many statistics and so many things on the screen, whereas, you know, back then you had to tell the story. And, you know, it was interesting to see some of the old broadcasts because, you know, it's a different style of broadcasting now because everything's in front of you.
Yeah, there's definitely too much stats today. Right. Yeah, I don't like it. I just want to watch the game.
Well, now, of course, now with the whole gambling influence, you have, you know, the odds on who's going to get the next goal, and it's, you know, it's overkill.
Oh, it's beyond overkill. They've brutally murdered their horse like 16 times over at this right now. Like I can't even watch pregame and postgame stuff anymore. It's just, or even intermission stuff. It's that bad.
Yeah.
Especially with the gambling stuff.
I mean, even the basic thing, like the time left in the period, you didn't know. Like if you're watching a game now, if you're fast forwarding, you can see the clock in the corner. They would maybe occasionally have the clock two or three times a period, but you had to constantly remind people, you know, how, what the situation was, what the score was, because you couldn't turn it on. You know, now you see the Capitals are beating someone 2-1, it's on the screen. But if you're tuning in on an old broadcast, you had to remind people because they probably showed it every 5 minutes.
Yeah. Like I actually enjoy the fact that you do it because like for me personally, like 88 playoffs, like I think at that point I had just moved to Maryland. I'm still like a 1 year old, not even two yet. So like seeing some of these games is actually really cool, at least, and that's just my perspective. I also like the simplicity of everything.
Well, the funny part too, the biggest reaction I've also gotten is some of the promos, because I have some of the old Home Team Sports jingles and the Capitals promos, and those are some of the most retweeted ones, which is funny. You know, people, a lot of the games you see from that era is just basically either the Easter Epic or the game against Philadelphia in 1988. A lot of that other era, you don't see a lot of tape, and I don't think a lot of tape exists in those years either. Because even when the Capitals did their anniversary stuff, I think their stock is very limited of what they have. I mean, it's basically probably what they have. You know, I'm sure they have some older tapes or highlights, but, you know, I don't think they really have a lot of games left, which, you know, 30 years ago, it's hard because, you know, obviously the VCRs are around anyway. And a lot of, you know, the attitudes once DVDs came out, people like, oh, we don't need the tapes anymore. So they get junked or they break or, you know, fall. You know, so it's been interesting. It's a great reaction. As I said, I love to, you know, if I, now that I digitize it, I have access to it. I can look up stuff by date, and I've tried to go into catalog some of the stuff. So, but it's been interesting. Like I said, it's a lot different than what it was, but, you know, as I said, that was really when the Capitals started to make inroads in Washington, because, you know, 82, they were on TV 20 games a year. There was the Save the Caps campaign because they weren't drawing well. And, you know, honestly, as we know now, television is basically a good advertising for all these teams. And if you're only on TV 20 times a year, you know, you don't get people to come out to the Cap Center to watch games. Once HTS came in, you saw home games, you saw a lot more advertisement for it. And, you know, I think obviously the team being good helped ticket sales, but also the team being on television a lot more also helped kind of established them as a, you know, at the time they were second behind the Redskins, but they kind of passed the bullets at the time. And, you know, by the end of the decade of the 80s, they were selling out. I think they had 23 sellouts at the end of the decade, the year after they beat the Flyers and lost to the Devils in game 7. So, you know, it was a big year for the team. And, you know, obviously there were 4 Hall of Famers on that team. So, you know, it was a really good hockey team. Unfortunately, they were stuck with some of the other good hockey teams of that year in the division. So, you know, it's not like a team like Minnesota can win the Norris division or, you know, some of these other teams that could get a little bit easier. I mean, you had the Islanders, you had the Flyers, you had, you know, the Rangers 1 year with Van Beesbrook, and then, you know, you started to have the Penguins getting good. And so it was a tough time, but, you know, it was a really good teams. And, you know, it was kind of fun to go back and see all those games.
Yeah. And, you know, and I'm thinking, like, because you're talking about like digitizing like old stuff from like 30 years ago, and it's interesting because I'm actually back in school and I'm taking a video editing class of all things, and I just turned
it's a lot easier now.
yeah, it definitely is a lot easier now. But like actually, one of the projects that I did, like we had to do a video editing project using only still pictures.
Right.
And I chose to do the 30-year career of The Undertaker in the WWE because he went into the Hall of Fame, you know, like earlier this month. So I thought, right, oh, this would be really cool. Finding pictures from when, like in the 90s, when he debuted, yep, and stuff like that, especially when one of the requirements was that it had to be HD photos. It was just so hard.
Well, you got to remember, you know, the whole thing with digital photos is the same way because, you know, now, you know, you go to an event, you take, even if you're a pro photographer, you're going to have a digital camera, you're going to fire off a couple hundred photos. because it's easy. You know, in those days, you had an SLR camera, which you could take maybe one picture every 5 seconds, and you had to go develop it. So at best, you didn't know what you had until about a half hour. You know, in the old days, when you shot hockey games, basically they would be in the camera well at the Cap Center or wherever. They would have shoot a couple rolls of film, black and white, because it was cheaper than color. And plus, you didn't need color for newspapers. So most of the stuff is black and white from that era. Then, you know, during the intermission, you'd have a little dark room and you'd have to go actually develop them. And then what you did is you basically picked one or two out, you transmit it to the Associated Press. I mean, now, obviously, if you're a guy with a camera, you can instantly download everything to your laptop and email the best ones. And, you know, you can afford to do 5 or 6 different photos because, you know, you did a burst of, you know, you did a quick burst of something. But, you know, back then it was much different because, as I said, you didn't have the ability to catch that many images. I think there's a stat out there now. You're seeing more photos taken now than any other point of human history because everyone has a cell phone. Everyone has digital photos and it's easy to do. You know, you don't have to take it to CVS. You don't have to get it developed. You don't have to go to a dark room and you don't have to go buy film, you know? So it's basically, people don't realize how much different the game was and covering the game was. I mean, I'll give you an example, the Easter Epic. One thing that people don't realize is the people covering the game ended up stopping working at midnight because all the deadlines were over. You know, if you had the next day's Washington Post, there's nothing about the Easter Epic other than it missed the print edition. You know, the story didn't come through till Monday. And, you know, that's how it worked. It was just a lot different. It was a lot slower. And obviously, you know, the technology now is so much greater. You're so used to having, you know, any kind of event, you have photos or video, you know, fans, press, you know, internet. And it was a lot different back then.
Yeah. And kind of interesting because I've had a massive gap between when I was in college to now when I'm kind of back. Yep. But one of the last classes I ironically took in my final semester back in 2007 was photography and working in a dark room and stuff like that. Yep. So it's kind of funny how I went from there to what I'm doing now. So it's kind of interesting. And for the record, I'm only 35 years old. I'm not an old man. Okay.
Yeah. No, it's, as I said, it's just interesting how it's all changed. Cause I said, you know, you look at the span between, you know, the Caps are turning 50 in 2 years. Yeah. You look at the difference between what a game was like then in terms of, you know, how you could watch it. You know, you had to have a TV. Cable was not prevalent at that point. All the games were on a broadcast television. They only did a couple of them. You know, newspapers, usually they got wire copy or, you know, they have one or two photos exist from every game because simply it was too time consuming to print, you know, more than a couple. They said, oh, this is good for the press. And, you know, once you got into the 90s, you started to see, you know, there are more games on TV. There were more advanced photo technology. You know, you still, once you got digital photos, it's a lot easier to take a lot more photos. I mean, you know, it's kind of like, it was weird, you know, back in the old day when you're developing film, I'm sure you remember this, you shot a roll of film, you were hopeful you got 5 good photos.
Yeah.
now you can, you know right away if it was a bad photo or not. You know, you didn't know until you developed, like, did I get the shot or not? Yeah. And, you know, it's obviously, you know, it was just a lot different. You know, that's part of the reason, you know, going back to the whole video, you know, a lot of these games don't exist. There's no one has them. You know, obviously a lot of the Stanley Cup playoff games exist somewhere.
Well, the NHL and the Hockey Hall of Fame have those games.
So yeah, they have some of them. I mean, they don't, a lot of it, you know, it used to be so difficult to have all the tapes.
Yeah.
And like I said, you know, the problem with home team sports, like I know we were discussing earlier about when the Capitals did, or the NHL did the 10 greatest games. There's only one from HTS on that DVD collection. It was the 88 Hunter game, the 96 game against Pittsburgh and 98 against Buffalo were all on ESPN. And I know when they did the Islanders Easter Epic one, they had to use the Hockey Night in Canada broadcast. So it was, you know, not a lot of copies exist. And it's, like I said, you know, it was one of those things, if I knew if I didn't do it, a lot of these games wouldn't exist. And as I said, we were discussing earlier, I've had ex-players reach out to me. I've had announcers reach out to me and ask because they don't have the clips. And, you know, I had some of the clips. I was able to send him what I had. So it was, that's kind of nice. You know, you're kind of preserving a little bit of history. And obviously now with technology, it can live, you know, in the cloud. So it's not, you know, it's easy to kind of dig up. You know, if I had to go find an old game, I would have to go fire up the VCR, put it in, fast forward to that game, just get that piece. This way I can just, you know, I know what happened when and kind of dig the pieces out of it.
Yeah, and I know that also recently because of your archiving of these games on YouTube, you've written a couple articles recently with input from like Alkoken and others.
Yep. They were,
to bring more awareness to like these games and stuff like that, which I also think is really cool because like something that you're just doing kind of like I don't want to say it's like a hobby, but in a way it kind of was because you're trying to keep yourself occupied during a pandemic.
Right.
You know, and it turns into this great resource to write articles on, you know?
Yeah, so I think really cool. Yeah, no, I mean, it's been fun because obviously I talked to Mike Forns and Alkoken, who are both terrific. You know, they've been part of Alkoken's been around since the team came in. Mike Forns is in that, you know, he was there from 84 to 90. And the great story is, you know, he kind of came in because Gordie Howe was hired as color commentator and they needed the play-by-play guy. And that's how we got the gig. So, but yeah, no, it's been fun. I mean, obviously a lot of it was, there was no games to watch. So it was easy. The TV was occupied. And like I said, I just let it run, you know, obviously the quality of the tapes aren't quite what you would hope from today's standards, but you know, I think they came out okay. Some of them better than others, but that's because, you know, cable television wasn't the same either. It wasn't like now where it's all digital. It was in a cable. It was actually a cable. And you know, sometimes they would take the DC 20 feed, which had ghosts and shadows because it wasn't a great signal. So, but yeah, it's been fun. I mean, it's nice to kind of revisit that era. It's kind of a lost era of Caps history because I think, like we were talking about, you know, the video, there isn't a whole lot of video from it. There isn't a whole lot of resources from it. So, you know, you didn't really get to see Langway play or Stevens play or anything like that.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. When you put up the, I think it was the 94 HTS intro, where it was right. Like kind of like the pinball.
Yes,
like I marked out so hard because I remember that as a kid. Seeing that people were Caps games, like you knew it was Caps night when you saw that intro. And like
I think the three I've gotten the most reaction to was that because of the pinball. People remember the pinball and they use the pinball for everything. You know, it didn't matter what they broadcast. The other two were the freeze frame intro from the 80s from DC20. And the other one was just the HTS jingle, the channel you cheer for. So those were the threes that I think that actually got the most retweets and reactions from just because people remember them. And like I said, you don't see them anymore. Obviously, home team sports doesn't exist as it did. It's still technically the same, but obviously it went through the Comcast phase and now it's obviously in NBC Washington. But yeah, it was a lot different. It was a well-run network for what it was. It was kind of ahead of its game and, I think it had a lot of good production value that people remember. And you don't see, you know, a lot of the, if you see like kind of a stuff like that now, it's team produced, which is a little bit different because it's trying to sell you something. You know, a lot of the times when you see in the intermission breaks, you'll see ticket ads or something like that where it's team related. It's still trying to sell you stuff. Whereas this is more just kind of like a, you know, the MTV style video montage of the day. You know, that's, you made videos and that's what people reacted to. You know, you hit a popular song, you put some videos in front of it. That's what a lot of networks did. And it's exactly what HTS has. And I think that's what a lot of people remember.
Yeah. Like I never really remember the freeze frame or the HTS jingle, but I definitely remember the pinball. So, but
the DC 21, as I said, they went generic later, but they used to, you also knew it was the DC 20 game when you heard it, and they always used it for the commercials and stuff like that. So it was, you know, kind of iconic. And it's, you know, it's strange to think it was freeze frame, you know, obviously it's a band from Boston. You don't think it's connected to Capitals hockey, but you know, that generation who watched, you know, you didn't have a lot of the DC area. You didn't have cable at that time. You know, Reston was built out. DC was built out, but a lot of the suburbs were growing and, you know, cable companies were struggling to keep up at that point.
One of the funny things is that for the DC 20, they use freeze frame, and Craig Lachlan's key tagline is "Hold it here."
Yep.
Was that foreshadowing, especially with how often Lachlan was shown in the DC 20 promos?
Well, it's funny because, you know, when Lachlan played, he was always known as, you know, he was a great quote. He had a really good personality, and that kind of foreshadowed why he eventually got, you know, the color commentary role. Because, you know, he's obviously a very popular player. He was a pretty good player when he came over from Montreal, but he wasn't quite the scorer that some of the other players were. He was a good, you know, fourth line guy, third line guy who hustled. And, you know, usually when he scored, it's funny, you know, if you see some of his goals from the era, it was a lot of deflections. It was a lot of hard work in front. I remember there was one he scored against, I believe it was the Islanders in the playoffs. He got knocked over and then he went and scored. And then people were surprised that, oh, he got knocked over, but he still got up and scored. I mean, that's what he was. He was kind of a plumber type of player, but that's what he was proud of. And he was just very outspoken. And, you know, he obviously, his playing time came to an end in Washington because he wasn't getting the ice time anymore. Went out to Los Angeles and Toronto, and, you know, you weren't sure what he would do next, but obviously, and he started in 1990, and obviously he's been doing it for, you know, 32 years since. He was with, you know, Jeff Rimmer and, you know, all the people who came after him, Kenny Albert, you know,
Dave Johnson.
Yeah, you know, obviously Al Kogan. Yep, Al Kogan's done play-by-play at times. He even did one this year. But yeah, so it's just funny to see. But yeah, that's how he was. You know, he was, you know, and the thing you got to remember too is you didn't see constant interviews with these guys. You know, it's not like today where you know, what Alex Ovechkin is like, you know, what John Carlson is like, you know, what Nick Backstrom is like. You would see maybe once a month on the local news or like an intermission. You wouldn't see constant, you know, practice videos. You wouldn't see, you know, what's this guy really like. You may see him sitting with Al Kokin, you know, behind a bunch of jerseys in the hallways of the Brendan Byrne Arena, but that's all you would see of him and you'd hear of him. Whereas now, you know, obviously players put out their own, you know, they have their own Twitter feeds. You just didn't know what the players were like, but Lachlan was able to kind of be one of the more popular people when TV wanted interviews. Cause you know, he's obviously loves to talk and, you know, that was pretty popular when you're in this business.
Yeah. And actually another person that's really good at talking and, you know, I really discovered it through when you're putting it up on Twitter is Alan May.
Yes.
Like the interviews of Lachlan interviewing Alan May, that,
yes, like, that got a reaction.
That was hilarious.
Yeah. And Alan, I thought he did an excellent job. I mean, he was, you know, I've talked to him after his playing career. He's a really smart guy. He knows the game. He really is a good tactician. And, you know, he was, in his heyday, he was an enforcer. He was a guy you were scared to play against. He was out there to make room for other players. You know, it's not like today's NHL where you have a guy like Tom Wilson who can play tough, but he can also play the game. You know, May could play a little bit, but his job was not to score goals. It was to basically make room for everybody else. And I thought that interview was really interesting because obviously Lachlan was in the first year, you know, he was still getting the handle of broadcasting, and May, you kind of saw where, you know, he basically saw a lot of what was going on in the game, even though he was involved. And I thought that was pretty interesting. And obviously that's one of the reasons I pulled that. So it was funny to see, you know, but, you know, both of them were obviously, it was very raw talent, but you still saw the talent there, why they're doing what they're doing now.
Yeah. And it's great. And then, you know, last point of, on this before we shift over, because obviously we can't talk history this entire time. We got to talk about some current stuff as well.
That's
one thing that we were also talking about before we started recording was like, one thing was that, and you mentioned it a bit too, is that like not every game would be aired.
Right.
Like you wouldn't see every regular season game. And something that a lot of Caps fans may not know, and I learned this when I was doing my research on the 97-98 Caps team, because I actually want to do a documentary on them, or, you know, maybe a book. That would be kind of cool to take the work that I put in and actually put it into something and see a finished product with it. But one of the things I learned was that when the Capitals played their last game at the Capitol Center before they moved to MCI Center, they retired Rod Langway's number, and the game was not televised. And that was the very last game at Cap Center.
Right. I mean, as I said, it's interesting to look that it's actually a recent phenomenon that you have all the games on television anyway. I mean, it's only in the last 15 years. I mean, it used to be, you know, the first decade of the franchise, they had 20 games on television, 15 to 20 games on TV, all broadcasts and almost all road games. There would be no home games. So if you wanted to go see the Caps at home, you had to go buy a ticket. Then HTS came in, and then you had about 50 games. You would have, you know, you would have 35 on cable, I believe like 15 to 20 on broadcast television. And it really wasn't until the 2000s when you started to have, you know, cable systems had more capacity. Because you got to remember, at the time with home team sports, you had the Orioles, you had the Bullets, you had the Caps, and you had a lot of college sports. And you got to remember, home team sports, one of their markets was Raleigh and Charlotte. And they, a lot of, there's a demand for college sports, especially ACC basketball and some of these other teams. So there's a lot of competition, and you only had one, maybe on a rare occasion, you have two channels. So one of the games won out. And you know, it was the same thing with DC 20. They carried the Capitals, the Bullets, and the Orioles. So you're all competing for basically to be carried. But once technology improved, you had more digital, you could have more digital channels. Then you start to see it would get to 60, then the 70. And then eventually, as I said, I believe it's around 2010 is when you started to see a full schedule. And, you know, even it's only been recently preseason games. But you got to remember, too, probably 30 years ago, maybe 20% of the NHL games weren't televised anywhere. You know, the home team didn't cover it. The road team didn't cover it. Obviously, teams like Toronto, Montreal, the Rangers, you probably had close to 80 games. You know, teams like Washington, Los Angeles, St. Louis, you probably only had, you know, a portion of the schedule. And if you have like Washington and Los Angeles, they may not be on TV anywhere. So, you know, that's, we were discussing it at the time. Sometimes the only thing, time you could see it was the highlights. And, you know, Capitals highlights were actually broadcast from the Capitol Center. You know, they gave them the telescreen feed. Obviously, the Caps were one of the first arenas to have in-game replay. It was, you know, that's another recent phenomenon, but they would pull those feeds for games that weren't on TV. So they only existed on the local news.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot of history, mostly on the TV side, which is awesome to actually talk about. But we do have current stuff. We do have an Islanders team to talk about. We have a Capitals team to talk about. Right. Maybe do a little Ranger talk because depending on how long we go, we may or may not have an Ethan on this show. So we have to give him some love and do a little Ranger talk. But I want to start with the Islanders because obviously the East is set.
Right.
You know, for the playoffs, the East is set. Islanders are out. There was some, I'm going to use the word delusion, that the Islanders were probably going to find a way to make it into the playoffs. You and I talked about that before. That wasn't going to happen. But, you know, everyone, you know, I want to jump into the very beginning of the season for the Islanders because what, and being how you live on Long Island, you're able to see a lot more than, like, say, me, where I'm in Maryland, I'm right outside DC, so I don't see it like you would.
Right.
The Islanders started the season with a 13-game road trip. But it was a very friendly 13-game road trip. You know, they had some tough ones, like against a Carolina or a Florida, you know. But, like, I'm looking at it now, and in October, they, between the Florida-Chicago games, they had 2 days in between, and they were able to go home and relax before heading out to Chicago. Then you had a stretch where they went out to Vegas, and then they played Nashville, but they had 5 days in between where they can go home.
Right.
Normally, if you have a 13-game stretch, you don't get to go home.
Right.
You know, and then you had another one between Nashville and Montreal where they had an extended break. Between Minnesota and the Devils, they had an extended break. But yet again, they're playing the Devils on the road. They can just go home that night. You know, it's kind of easy. So, like, obviously, it wasn't a very successful one for them to start the season. And everyone kind of blames the fact, oh, well, they're on the road the entire time. But they got to spend so much time at home in between a lot of these games. What really went wrong with the Islanders to start the season, in your opinion?
Well, I think the roots started in actually the last two off seasons. I thought, you know, losing Letty to Seattle for nothing, or not Letty to Seattle, Eberle to Seattle for nothing. You know, getting rid of Letty. Basically, you're giving away a lot of talent. I mean, the Islanders, they basically were the last 2 years an okay regular season team who could play playoff style hockey. The trick is, it's very difficult to do that over the last 82 games. And I know we talked about this before. You know, if you look at the trajectory of the last two regular seasons before this one, the Islanders looked like they were going to fall out of the playoffs both years. But because of obviously the pandemic shortened the season, they were able to get the points percentage into the tournament, the bubble tournament. And obviously they were able to play a solid playoffs. Last year, they were starting to tail, but it was only a 56 game year. I mean, the difference between Barry Trotz in Washington and Barry Trotz in the Island is Barry Trotz could play the Capitals different ways because they were capable of scoring goals. They were capable of playing defense. But here, they have to play one way. They have to play defensive. They have to kind of limit, you know, it's typical old Devils hockey. And I think what happened is you kind of shed some talent. You know, you basically get nothing for Eberle. You get nothing for Letty.
Remember, they traded Devin Taves away to Colorado, and they got like nothing for him.
Yep, and even Andrew Ladd is doing stuff in. You know, obviously Ladd wasn't fitting in here, but you gave him away because you're trying to clear cap space, which you used for Kyle Palmieri, who obviously was decent in the playoffs. But you know, you don't give him that long. He's not getting that on the open market. But you know, I think what happened is you had the road trip. They didn't want to play at the Coliseum. And I think that was a mistake because, like, even though it was they were able to go home, you got to remember they weren't really home for the preseason either. So they come in September. They don't play until for 2 months in a game on Long Island. And I think, you know, towards the end of the road trip when they hit Florida, you start to see the COVID issue hit as well. So it kind of obviously by the time they got home, they were getting into a full-fledged COVID issue. Although I will say there's a narrative now that destroyed their season where if you look at man games lost for injury and COVID, the Islanders are now one of the least all across the league. They just buried themselves into such a big hole. And, you know, I've said on Twitter, it's so difficult to make up points with the loser point now. I believe I looked it up. The most is either 13 or 14 points by the Senators. It was like 2000. It was towards the beginning, sometime last decade, they were down 13 points, went on a crazy run and got in the playoffs. But no team has gone further back in the playoffs and ended up making it. And they were at one point, you know, they were 20 points out. And basically, you know, they were playing well for a while. But I think the problem is they're a borderline playoff team. And what really hurt them this year is the Rangers got good because obviously the Rangers in essence took their spot because pretty much everyone else who made it in this year made it in last year. It's just the Rangers moved up and the Islanders just didn't have, you know, they didn't have it. You know, like they took some gambles. None of them paid off, you know, between the road trip, losing guys out instead of trying to get more value. And then just, you know, and the trade deadline was puzzling. I thought at least you get rid of guys like Chara, get rid of guys like Parisi, you'll get something, Andy Green, get something back for him. You hold on to them for what? And, well, you know, they're going to be, you know, they're 17 points out now.
Well, I mean, let's put this in perspective. You mentioned Chara, you bring up Parisi, you bring up Green. Well, apparently it came out in Elliot Friedman's 32 Thoughts blog that before Palmieri signed his deal, and I think with his extension around the deadline, and with Chara, Lamoriello told them, "I'm not going to trade you unless you actually want to be traded." And apparently neither of them wanted to be traded. And I think Chara kind of wants to end his career with the Islanders the way he started it, which is respectable. But also at the same time, when you look at a guy like Kyle Palmieri, Zach Parise, Zdeno Chara, Andy Green, Cal Clutterbuck, Matt Martin, and Casey Zizekas, yeah, I just named seven guys right there.
Right.
I wouldn't touch any of them with a 10-foot pole if I'm a general manager of another NHL franchise.
Well, the crazy thing is, you know, you mentioned Matt Martin. He was on the protected list for Seattle. Like, not only did they not lose, you know, offer him up, they basically said, we're going to use a spot we could have used for Eberle, protect a guy then they're not going to take anyway. I mean, I think the long term, they were worried they were going to lose a defenseman. So they kind of dangled Eberle, but you can't do that. You can't give away a lot of talent, not get anything in return, especially when you're a team. You know, like I said, there was an attitude, I think, with Lamoriello that they were one of the four best teams in the league last year. No, they weren't. You know, they got further in the playoffs than a lot of teams, but a lot of that was, you know, they faced a team in Pittsburgh who was kind of made to play the Islanders because their goaltending was suspect and the Islanders could shut him down. And they got, you know, when it turned out Tuukka Rask was kind of getting hurt. You know, they had two really good match opponents for them in the first two rounds. And, you know, eventually against Tampa, they just ran out of gas. And obviously Tampa is a much better team. But, you know, you kind of delude yourself into thinking you're better than you are and you make these kind of decisions. And I think that's what happened. And I think, you know, even at the trade deadline, they didn't look like they were going to make it, but they looked like you're going to be, oh, we're just going to miss, you know, just a kind of. But, you know, what I've seen of the Islanders this year, they can do really well against the seven teams below them. But they've had a lot of problems against the eight teams above them, which is obviously, if you're a serious cup contender, you're not going to get to play, you know, Buffalo or Detroit in the playoffs.
Yeah. And not only that, but the other thing is, and Islander fans need to understand this too, you don't have anything coming in that pipeline.
No.
You don't have the picks. You don't have the prospects. You're in a downward spiral. I wouldn't be surprised if, in the next season or two, they're picking top five because of it, because of these decisions.
The problem is, halfway through the season when the Islanders were really struggling, at some point you're like, the worst thing you can do is finish ninth because you're not going to make the playoffs and you're not getting a good pick. So, you know, they were down near the bottom of the East, and then obviously they made it more respectable. A lot of that is the goaltending has been good. They've been playing more of the system, and also they've gotten, you know, they got a lot of points in the teams they should be. But, you know, at some point, long range, you can't do what they're doing. And, you know, they didn't even get picks from the guys that didn't trade the deadline. And, you know, I think that what it is Lou Lamoriello looks for certain types of players to play the system. And the problem is you have guys like Barzal has not looked as good this year because he's playing in the system. You know, a guy like Wahlstrom is a really good player. But I think it's, you're not playing an offensive type system. You're not going to put up the numbers that you're used to. And you got to play a lot more defensive responsibility than you do on most teams. And I think the problem is they're kind of cornered themselves into playing one style of hockey, playoff style hockey, which is very difficult to carry over 82 games without being tired. And you're already a team that's probably on the bubble anyway. Like, as I said, I thought, you know, there was a lot of predictions the Islanders would go to the finals, they would win the Metro. And I thought at best they're going to be a bubble team. I thought, you know, they may be 7, 8, 9, but they're going to be, have to do, not have a bad year. And pretty much everything went wrong for them that could go wrong, both on and off the ice. And I think, you know, I'm not sure what they're going to do in the offseason because they've burned a lot of cap space that they traded guys like Eberle and Letty and Ladd to clear. You know, so Palmieri could have a deal that they easily could have signed him a lot cheaper on the open market. They didn't, it was unnecessary.
That and Palmieri deal made no sense.
Right. I mean, you're a team, they're near the cap. You know, the goaltending's obviously the thinking is Varlamov is going to get dealt in the offseason, but also obviously Sorokin's going to get a lot more money soon, and you got to clear room for that because, you know, he's probably going to get some Vezina votes. He probably won't win the Vezina, but his numbers are very, very good. And he's probably kept the Islanders from being a really, you know, falling down into that lower seven teams. You know, they're kind of in between, you know, the eighth spot and the 10th spot. They're not really good enough to be in the eight, but they're probably better than the other teams in the, you know, the bottom seven. So they're kind of where they are. And, you know, they have to add some speed. They have to add some youth. And they need to kind of be able to be a little bit more open with what style they play, because, you know, you're playing teams like Toronto, they're trying to play 2-1 in October, and, you know, that wears on a team awful quick.
Yeah, it, not only that, but it kind of comes down to, and I've used this before on Twitter, I've said this before, but at the end of the day, everything goes through Lou, and Lou is very draconian with a lot of things.
Yes.
And Lou kind of needs to get out of the way, and like, because like we know down here in DC what Trotz can do when he's given the talent to work with. He, like, we saw how Ovechkin bought in, you know, to play defense, to do what needed to be done to play that playoff hockey to win a Stanley Cup. So it's like, we know Trotz can do that, but when you're dealt the hand that Trotz has, you know, there's only so much Trotz can do. But like, at the same time, Lou needs to kind of get out of the way and be like, okay, you know, this isn't working. You know, it's good to have this for the playoffs, but you know,
right.
But I don't think that vision's going to lose out of there.
Yeah, no, and there's a question, you know, I think he'll come back next year, but, you know, I think he's kind of priming his son to take over the team eventually. So I don't know how that'll change. But like you were saying, you know, Trotz, the Capitals in during the Trotz era had the ability to play offensive and defensive, but the Islanders really don't. They can't play, you know, they try to win games 2-1. That's their style. And, you know, it's difficult when you're in the doldrums of December and January. And like, you know, I think the whole thing with the second half of this year, you're not going to reel off a 12 or 13 game winning streak playing that kind of hockey. You're going to, you can be overall pretty decent, but it's so hard to make up numbers. You know, they, like I said, when you're getting 20 points out, you really have to run the table. And this is not the team that can run, you know, obviously they piled up some wins against some bad teams, but they've had the, I think besides the Rangers, they've had a lot of difficulty beating the Eastern playoff teams. And even last night, you know, obviously the Rangers kind of went in there and kind of ran the table. I think you're seeing a lot of the, they know they're not in the playoffs anymore. And so you're not going to play that responsible defensive game, but I just don't think they don't have the talent level. I mean, I think the best case scenario for the Islanders is what they got the last couple of years is you get in, you get a couple of favorable matchups and you win them. But I mean, I never saw them as a serious Stanley Cup contender. And I think they're going to have to add some forwards and a little bit more speed and youth to even get back in the conversation for that.
Yeah. I mean, and I'm actually going to shift this over to the Rangers. That was a great segue that you did there where you talked about the game last night between the Islanders and the Rangers. Like, you look at what Chris Drury has done with them and, you know, bring Ryan Reeves. Okay. You bring some muscle, but how often is that guy really going to be playing in the playoffs? You know, because, you know, he's not a hockey player. He is one of the last enforcers truly of the NHL. And
right.
But like, you look at the trade deadline, what the Rangers did now going into this season, I had the Flyers, the Caps, and then I kind of had it in a bubble thing between the, I had the Hurricanes, the Caps, and the Flyers with the Penguins, the Rangers, and the Islanders kind of in a bubble. You know, I had them in a bubble because I knew Carolina was going to be great this season, no matter what. Like, and they have hit those expectations that I knew Carolina would bring. And you knew the Caps would still find a way to make the playoffs, so I wasn't surprised by them. Philly was a major disappointment, but that's something we'll talk about another time because I talk to my father all the time about it, and one thing I disagree with you on that you and I talked about is about Carter Hart, but we'll talk about it another time. Right. I think the big thing for the Flyers is Chuck Fletcher is not a real NHL general manager, and Dave Scott is not a hockey guy at all, and that he needs to get out of there, and they need a real general manager in Philadelphia. Kind of like, oh, I don't know, Ron Hextall, like who they fired, who was doing all the right moves. But that's why the Flyers are where they're at now, because they've completely undid everything. But Drury in New York with the Rangers, like that trade deadline that he had was really good. Like you got an Andrew Kopp, a Tyler Mott, who unfortunately is now injured and may not even play at this point now. And then he also picked up Frank Vetrano. And right. I'm like, look, and it's like, those are three really good pickups. And Vetrano has been on fire since joining the Rangers, and so has Kopp. And they kind of add, they actually bring more legitimacy to their bottom six than what they had with the bottom six before the deadline. And I'm not trying to make a knock on Reeves, even though it's probably an easy thing to do as a DC fan, you know, but, you know, Reeves does have a role and he plays it well, but Andrew Kopp and Frank Vetrano are definitely upgrades.
Yeah. I mean, I think the Rangers, I think it all started with Gerard Gallant. I think he's such a good coach. I mean, he did a great job in Florida, a great job in Vegas. He's able to get a team to buy in. I'll say, like, you know, David Quinn, obviously I saw him a lot at Boston University. I think his strength was recruiting, which is obviously big in college hockey, whereas the pros, you don't have that for a head coach. And I think Gallant is a lot more of a player's coach than Quinn was. So I think you see a lot more. I didn't think their roster over the summer was better, but I thought their coaching was going to be a lot better. And I think you could get a lot more out of what he had. And I think you're seeing a team, obviously, with, you know, Shesterkin is doing terrific work. Their power plays, obviously, Kreider's, you know, come out of nowhere basically to have a 50-goal season. And I think the players they got kind of enhance what they have. I think what's going to happen with the Rangers, it's going to be interesting who they draw, because I think there's some teams that they match up well against, and I think there's some teams they don't necessarily match up well against. I think the goaltending obviously needs to hold up, because I think on nights where they've either used a backup or they've Igor's been off, I think they've shown to be very mortal and very average. I think the power play, that's another issue for the playoffs, whereas you're not going to see a lot of power plays in games 5 through 7 of a series. So that would be give me a little bit of pause. But I think they can still be dangerous. I think the goaltending, you know, obviously with Jari out in Pittsburgh and Anderson out in Carolina, they may have the best goaltending of the Metro bracket, which is obviously a huge advantage. Yeah. You know, and I think obviously a goaltender can take you a long way. But I do think, you know, I think I was similar to you. I saw the Capitals were going to get in, Penguins were going to get in, and I thought the Hurricanes were going to get in. And I thought it was going to be 4, 5, 6 was going to be between the Islanders, Rangers, and Flyers. And I thought, obviously, you know, I thought the Islanders would have a little bit more jump to them. The Flyers have been a disaster. But, you know, the Rangers basically took that last spot and ran with it. I mean, they could win the division. But you know, I think Gallant's got a good system. The players believe in him. They believe in the way they're playing, and, you know, they've got talent there. As I said, I didn't think they were as talented as they were last year, but I think they're much better coach. And obviously that makes them a much more dangerous team in the playoffs.
Yeah. And just to throw this out there, like Gallant, I actually like Gallant. I think when the Caps were looking for their next coach, I had Gallant right up there of somebody who I would have grabbed. Because yes. He's that good of a, but the one thing about Gallant, and this is kind of a knock on Pierre Laviolette too, is they don't last very long in their cities.
Right.
So like we remember the infamous thing that happened to him with Florida with when Dave Talon was the general manager, which that was really Bush League of Talon to do. But yeah, it's just kind of interesting seeing how
I think like if you want to compare Gallant to Laviolette, I think Gallant's biggest thing, he seems to clash a little bit with management. I think you have a little bit more friction than Laviolette with. I think Laviolette ends up losing the room at times. I think Gallant, it's more you know, he may question some of the, I don't know this for a fact, but you know, I think there's more friction with what the lineup he's given. And I think that's sometimes where it comes from. Obviously, Vegas has had a ton of change. And I think, you know, I just – sometimes general managers want guys who are yes men, and they'll put out the guys they're given, and some are very vocal. I mean, obviously, you know, the famous thing with Gallant was, you know, he had to get a cab from the rink.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, I think a lot of that is – I think it's, you know, there's some clashes with management. I think that sometimes, you know, general managers are kind of, I'm done with it, but I think he's an excellent coach. I think he's a great motivator. And like I said, the Rangers are a team. I don't think they're a true cup threat. I don't think they're going to win 4 rounds. I do think they're capable of getting to the Eastern Conference Finals, just as long as the goaltending's good and they kind of keep the series short, where they can keep the power plays more of an impact of the game rather than, say, a 6 or 7 game series where they're going to have to rely on them.
Yeah, and just to throw this out there, because I have a feeling we may not have Ethan on because I'm looking at time and how long we've been going. But sorry, Ethan, next week, buddy. But the last four games for the Rangers as of recording, which is Friday, you know, April 22nd, they take on Boston in Boston, and then they finish off the season on at home where they take on Carolina, which obviously would have Metro Division implications of who could potentially be in first place. They take on the Canadiens, and then they finish the season hosting the Washington Capitals. So three of their last four are against playoff teams. And one of which, and actually two of which really have metropolitan ramifications for playoffs, because, you know, when you look at the Capitals, like tonight they're playing Arizona. Why God, is it a 10:30 at night game? But then we have Toronto on Sunday, the Islanders on Tuesday and Thursday, and then the Rangers, obviously, as I mentioned, on Friday to close out the season. So, like, for the Capitals, they're looking at where they could potentially land. The Penguins are still kind of doing what they're doing, and they have Tristan Jarry out at least through the first round because of a broken foot. So that's a blow to Pittsburgh in that regard. So looking at the Metro and looking at the Capitals, I'm going to shift it now to the Caps, but still kind of have that little focus on the Rangers. Who do you think the Caps match up better going into the playoffs? Do we match up better against Carolina if they take the two, or do we match up better against the Rangers if they take number two? Or if we stay in the wild card spot that we're in, do we match up better against Florida?
Right. I think this is going to be a tricky answer, because there's a who do they match better in the first round against? I would probably say Florida, because Florida is going to be dealing with a lot of expectations. However, the big problem with Florida is you're going to get sucked into the Atlantic bracket. And I think they're a horrible match against Tampa. And that's the team you're probably going to see. You know, it's probably going to end up being Tampa, Toronto. I can't see Toronto surviving that series. And I think Tampa is the absolute worst match Washington could have. Whereas if you play the Rangers or the Hurricanes, then you're basically going to play the other one in the second round. That's a little bit more winnable matchup. I mean, if you're looking to win a round, I think Florida slightly. I mean, I think they're going to be underdogs in all these series. And I think it would take good goaltending, which we haven't always seen this year, as we know. And it would take, you know, some good scoring. I think Florida would probably be the team they could beat, you know, maybe like 30, I give them a 35% chance of surviving that series. Plus, I mean, the other thing you got to talk about Florida is, you know, they always draw, Washington always draws well down there. You're probably going to have a couple extra home games, you know, because you have a lot of capital support in South Florida. You know, you get cheap flights down there. You know, whereas obviously the Rangers and, you know, Carolina, obviously they have a history of support too, but Carolina is a great home barn as well for the playoffs. But Florida, I mean, I think you can see that. But as I said, if you get Florida, your problem is not that round. If you win, you're going to be in a whole lot of trouble in the second round. Whereas if you stay in the Metro bracket, I think you have a much better chance of getting to the third round. You know, even though, again, it's not a big chance for Washington, but I think if you have more than winning one round hopes, I think you want to get either the Rangers or Carolina.
Although I will give the Caps the benefit of the doubt, and I'm actually taking a look at this super quick. I'm trying to pull it up, because one of the good things that the NHL does is give you like the history between teams.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully the Capitals played is it going to give me here? Probably not. No, it doesn't give it to me on here. It gives it to you on the phone though, when you look at it on the phone. But the Capitals actually kind of do match up okay with Tampa, because like I'm trying to do a quick skim of their season series, and I know they won the last game against Tampa Bay 4-3, and that was earlier this month,
right?
And then Tampa won.
Right. I think the thing to remember though is when you win the cup, kind of realize the regular season doesn't mean what you think it does before you win the cup. And I think there's a lot of lying in the weeds with Tampa. I think Tampa is my pick out of the East. I think they've got the goaltending, they've got the forwards, they've got the defense. They haven't been playing well in the regular season, but at some point you realize they don't care. They don't care about winning the division. They don't care about seeding. They just care about getting to the playoffs and getting in there. You know, obviously, you know, I think it'll be interesting for watching the last week. You were talking about next week they get the Islanders. and the Rangers. Who knows if the Rangers will be playing anything for that point? How much are the Islanders going to want to be playing spoiler? I mean, I said a couple days ago, in their last five, I think Washington has to go 3-5. Obviously, I was not the Penguins to beat the Bruins as they did last night. But, you know, the interesting thing about that race is almost all the tiebreakers are identical. It's going to matter if the Penguins win more games in overtime or, you know, if the Caps win a couple of games in shootouts, it's not going to help them. But and they could also catch Boston. I mean, problem is Boston's been struggling, you know, and then you're at least flipped to back to the Metro Division if you pass the Bruins. They're two back, but, you know, the Bruins have some tough games going up and Pasternak's been out, so their offense has been struggling. And, you know, I do think the Capitals will not end up in the eighth spot. I think they will. I think they'll end up in the seventh spot or the three spot. I don't think they'll end up one of those other teams. And I also think there's another factor. I don't think the Penguins want to play the Rangers. The Penguins have been terrible against New York. Again, we were talking about the Islanders who were a great match for the Penguins. The Rangers are a great match for the Penguins too. They've won all three games in pretty handy fashion. And I don't think the Penguins would survive. And they may say, well, we'd rather take our chances at Florida. Again, with the game, you'd have lots of Penguins fans there. For the road games, and, you know, I take your chances because I don't think they want the Rangers, but we'll see. It's going to be a strange week. You know, this week is very unpredictable. You don't know which teams are actually going to play out the string and which ones are just going to run for the bus, because you will see a lot of both next week.
Yeah. And just to throw this out there for the Bruins, their last five games are against the Rangers, the Canadiens, the Panthers, the Sabres, who have been red hot lately, and the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Yep.
So you potentially have like almost three different types of matchups right there for Boston.
Right. I mean, if the Capitals win the game against Arizona, they're going to end up tied with, they'll be tied in points with the Penguins and Bruins. They don't have the tiebreaker on each, but, you know, the Bruins will have a game in hand, but the Caps will be even. So it's going to depend on, you know, basically they either have to match the Penguins and get regulation wins, or they'll have to get one more point if they match regulation wins. And the Bruins are going to need another point because they're not going to win a tiebreaker against Boston.
And just for this out there, for Pittsburgh, they have four games left. They're playing in Detroit, then they play in Philadelphia, then they play at home against Edmonton and Columbus. Right. So Pittsburgh, in a way, I mean, I know Detroit's been playing a spoiler a little bit when they've been playing, but outside of Edmonton, that's an easy schedule for Pittsburgh.
Yeah, but they've had a lot of games where they should have won.
Yeah.
You know, they're a team that's come in and, you know, on paper, you're like, oh, they're going to blow them out. And they don't play well. And in games like last night where the Bruins are, you know, the Penguins haven't been playing well, the Bruins have been playing decently. And so I think that's very hard to predict. You kind of have to look at the numbers, I think. I think, you know, Washington will end up winning. Toronto is kind of a toss-up game for them. The Islanders, you may end up splitting. And the Rangers, like I said, that game may be meaningless for the Rangers. So you may see a lot of guys sit out. But it may mean a lot for the Rangers. You just don't know at this point. And The same thing about some of the games next week. You know, Toronto is kind of locked in. They're probably going to end up in the two seed. So who knows if they're going to sign to try to sit guys. And you also have the fact that I get the sense with Laviolette, he isn't necessarily overly concerned with seeds because obviously he had Backstrom sit out a game earlier this month. You know, if they have a chance to take it, great. But at some point, is it going to matter a whole lot if they want to get some guys some rest? Like I said, I mean, I think the three teams the Caps have, in ways they match up well against them and in ways they don't. But I don't think there's one team that's an absolute killer. As I said, I think Florida carries a caveat if that division's a killer. But I also think, I'm not sure Laviolette really cares, because you got to remember, you know, he went to the finals of the Flyers when they were one of the bottom seeds. So,
yeah.
And this is a team that, you know, quite frankly, plays a better game on the road. So, you know, this is their first year. They're not going to have home ice in the first round in a decade, but they're also a much better team away from home now than they are at home.
Yeah. Now we got to talk about them. We haven't talked about them yet. This is our overtime. Alex Ovechkin. He hit 50 the other night, ninth season of hitting that, tying Gretzky and Bossy. He's now 22 goals from passing Gordie Howe. With five games left, knowing the schedule that the Capitals have, How many more goals do you theoretically see Ovechkin scoring, knowing the type of schedule that they have and the type of opponents that they're playing?
I mean, I think you're going to see Ovechkin probably sit one of those last two games, one of the ones in New York. I think you'll probably see three or four because I think they'll be feeding him. Obviously tonight would be a game against Arizona that he could put a couple in. Toronto doesn't exactly play a good defensive style. Maybe he gets one or two in that game. I think, maybe top end he gets five. I think he gets a couple more just because of who they're playing. But I also don't think he's going to play in every game down the stretch. I think he's going to sit out. He probably will sit out against the Islanders, maybe the Rangers, but I think he'll play the home games after tonight, but he may not play. He probably won't play both of the away games, and he may not play in either of them either. But I think he'll end up with, maybe 52, 53 is probably a safe bet. Like I said, he could get up to 55, but, we'll see.
Yeah, I was kind of having that conversation at work with a couple coworkers that are asking me, like, how realistic. And the interesting thing is at the beginning of the season, I kind of predicted 52 goals for Ovechkin, and I'm kind of close. I'm not one of those predictor guys, but I did pretty good this season on the goals for Ovi. So
yeah, I thought the 50, I thought he would stay in the lineup until he got 50. And then, like I said, I think, obviously he's probably only going to miss one or two of the last five, but I do think that they're going to rest him. I think at some point they're going to say, we want to get you a little bit of rest before the playoffs. Obviously the playoffs are going to start the second. So toward the end of next week, I think you'll see him miss one of the games in New York, just because I think they're going to want to get him some rest before the playoffs. Cause seeding is nice, but I get the feeling that they really want to focus on the playoffs.
Yeah, and not only that, but to be honest, with Sunday being fan appreciation night, you're going to want to see Ovechkin play. And then now that they announced yesterday that on Tuesday night when they host the Islanders for the first of their home and home, they're going to be doing an Alex Ovechkin appreciation night where they're honoring him. And I think people would want to see him play in that game as well. So I could, just like what you're saying, that the two games in New York, I could see him sitting those two. Yeah. And maybe even with Backstrom and Kuznetsov and Wilson, a couple other guys, could be sat down just for the sake of hey, rest up, get ready for the playoffs. We got a long grind ahead of us.
Exactly. And I think, I think it gets like preseason where you see a lot of the stars at home, but you don't necessarily bring the A team on the road. I mean, obviously the Rangers, you probably don't want Wilson out there in the last game of the regular season.
We don't need another bloodbath.
Exactly. I mean, that's a lot. You'd look at last year, that probably did him a lot more harm than good to have that at the end. It wasn't quite the end of the regular season, but it really carried the narrative through the last week. And you kind of just want to get to the playoffs. And, maybe the Rangers want to send a message. But I think at this point, I don't think Laviolette is quite as concerned about seeding as we are. And, the players probably aren't either. They're kind of like, well, we'll see who we'll see. You got it. The players' mantra is you got to beat everyone in front of you. I think the three teams Washington face, there's scenarios where they could win and there's scenarios where they could lose. They're not going to be the favorite in any of them. Like I was saying about the Panthers, I think the Panthers are going to have a lot of pressure as a top seed. And I'm not quite sure, obviously Washington fans remember when Capitals were the top seed, but they weren't really used to handling it. It's a big burden when everyone says how great you are and how you're going to roll through the playoffs. And, New York will be kind of the same way because obviously the Rangers have been a great story. They end up winning the Metro. You're going to have the media talking about how great a team this is. And, it's Carolina's still got something to prove last year too. They went in the Central. Everyone thought they were going to roll and, they ended up losing to Tampa in the second round. So, all these teams they'd be facing are going to have high expectations and they haven't necessarily met them yet. And so the Capitals, obviously, it's kind of a role reversal. They're going to be the team with experience and they kind of have to build the pressure on the opponent. And, honestly, being the road team, you basically have to steal one of the first two games and then you steal home ice and it's a much different series. So it's a lot easier in this case for them to be the road team than, the top seed.
Yeah, and not only that, but it's kind of nice that they're not going to be at home or have home ice advantage for once, because they kind of need that. Like, and that was kind of the thing that helped them in 2018 as well. It's like, yeah, they had the first round, they had home ice advantage over Columbus and stuff like that. But like all the other series, I think they were the road team going in. Because I know they're a road team against Vegas in the final.
Yeah, the first two rounds they had home ice, but remember they won every series on the road.
Yeah.
They didn't win a single round at home. You know, they won game six in Columbus, they won game six in Pittsburgh, game seven in Tampa, and game five in Vegas. But you know, they it's a weird thing because obviously people are used to them being so dominant at home. And you know, if you put the road record at home, they would be the top seed in the East. It's just, you know, they basically at home have been barely would qualify for the playoffs. I think a couple games ago was a 93-point pace. You know, you'd probably qualify, but, you know, there were like 118-point on the team on the road, 93 at home. And, you know, fans are just not used to that. And I think part of it is you have a simpler game. I think they protect the goalie a lot more on the road than they do at home. I don't think they try to make the cute plays that they do at home on the road. And I think they play a much simpler game. And it's going to be interesting in the playoffs if they decide, you know, we're going to start playing this at home, or if they continue to try to, you know, they try to entertain the fans. They know it. And it's a little bit different when you're on the road because you're basically trying to play spoiler. And, you know, they're obviously much more effective this season playing the spoiler than playing bandwagon hockey.
Yep. So with that, Ted, you are the author of Chasing the Dream, Life in the AHL, Red Rising, and Transition Game. You're the Capitals contributor for the Hockey Writers. Where can the people find you on social media, good sir?
You can find me at Ted Starkey, T-E-D-S-T-A-R-K-E-Y. And you also, if you want to check out the games, I have my YouTube channel, also Ted Starkey. Like I said, that's become a very popular item in the last couple of months, but that's basically where I am. And obviously, we'll be doing stuff in the Hockey Writers. We're doing a lot of history. We did a biopic of the Easter Epic, the Dale Hunter game against Philadelphia, the birth of home team sports. There'll be one more coming down the pike next week. So you can look forward to that.
All right. And then, of course, obviously, TXHT is an affiliate of Cool Hockey. Click on the link below. And we're also going to add a special tweet into our posting of the podcast, because with the passing of Mike Bossy and Guy Lafleur, Cool Hockey is actually having it where if you buy Guy Lafleur or Mike Bossy jerseys, 100% of the profits will be going to charity, which will be the Chum Foundation. So I will have that posted up in the post with the podcast. And obviously, if you click any of our links, we do get a minor portion of the sale. So do that, helps us continue to do what we do here. And for me, you can follow the show on Twitter at @TXHT_hockey, Facebook at facebook.com/TXHT hockey. And of course, everything is here on the website at TXHTHockey.com, where we also in our dailies share Mr. Starkey's historical articles on the Hockey Writers, because they're amazing. So with that, Ted, thank you again for coming on. Ethan, I do apologize for us going into overtime on this. We'll get you back on next week, Ethan, I swear. This was great, Ted. I greatly appreciate it.
Yes, long overdue, but always a good conversation.
Yeah, we'll definitely have you back on during the playoffs, because obviously there's going to be so much more that we got to talk about. So,
exactly. So, great to be on.
All right. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, until next time, we will see you on the ice.